May we have a little review? I don't know whether they had 1 point, 2 points, or 3 points yesterday. But if there were any points, would you just review them right into the microphone?
One of the marks of leadership is a man that gets the job done.
Okay. This might be called the production versus personality characteristics.
The second thing, according to the Air Force criteria, was to be utilized all available resources.
Okay.
We talked about three types of leadership, autocratic, democratic, and you called it personal. That's a third type. Is it related to these other two objectives? Perhaps we hit that first.
Mommy! What is the type of leadership in which we have a particular interest?
The latter, personal.
What is the definition of leadership? Working definition.
I think you're the one you gave was accomplishing your objectives through others.
Accomplishing your objectives through the efforts of others. Right. Now, what is the most common failure in leadership?
Lack of judgment.
Okay, somebody express it in some other language.
Lack of accurate evaluation of the problem.
Making decisions on the basis of what were our two criteria inferences rather than observations.
Inability to analyze the situation.
Okay. Now, did anybody discover that this might possibly be an area in your life that might need some strengthening?
Careful.
I think it's anybody found out it wasn't.
I don't think anybody got 11 out of 11.
I was reading another book last night Harvey Soderholm gave me, Engineering, Creative Engineering Design. And I read a problem in there that illustrates this very point. There was an engineer, I wonder if I've got a page turned down here. I don't think I did on that one. But he got on the train in Cleveland at 10 o'clock at night to go to New York on the overnight train because he had an important business engagement at 9 o'clock the next morning. So he got all dressed, everything. Then he wanted something. He couldn't find the porter. So he put on his, after he'd already undressed, put on his robe and his slippers, and he went to the next car. And it happens there's some switching going on. So when he started back to the next car, he found out he was at the end of the train. So he had a great problem. And his problem was how to get his clothes back. So he really worked on it. But actually, that wasn't his problem. Was it? What was his problem?
Well, get back in the right train.
The problem was... meet the appointment the next day at 9 o'clock.
All right, we're getting a step closer. That doesn't prove that
these word prayer. Or get some clothes and then meet the appointment.
Well, now, when he was disconnecting with the car, then he wasn't going to the train to New York, is that right?
Yeah, he was going to the train. His clothes were left behind.
Well, his problem was created then when before he got on the train because he was assigned to the wrong car. Rather than be assigned to the right
character. Well, now we want to bog down us, but when he solved his problem, it was how to get the information that he needed to contribute and to gather at the appointment. That was the real problem he had to work on. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it? It wasn't how to get his clothes back. It wasn't how to get himself there. That would have been some steps in it. But provided it didn't look like that he could get some clothes that fit him and get there, the problem he started to work on is how do I get the information I have at the conference and gather what I would get if I were personally there. Well, I don't think that's too good an example, but I just read it last night. that we start to work on the wrong problem. Now, why do you suppose that he wanted to get his clothes back?
Expediency.
He was a coward.
He was afraid of what people thought if he showed up in his robe and his slippers at that meeting. Well, what are the four things that can affect a person's judgment, or should affect them one way or the other?
Expediency, social pressure, legalism, and morality. Principle.
Okay, now let me read from this book another statement here. If an engineer is to come up with unusual solutions to his problems, and if he is to overcome, to some extent at least, the emotional, cultural, and perceptual blocks which are thrown in his way. He's listed here emotional, cultural, and perceptual blocks that are thrown in his way. He must develop or improve the following personal traits. 1, self-confidence. 2, constructive nonconformity, not be a beatnik. Willingness to take calculated risks. Openness to experience. Active curiosity. Sensitivity to problems. High motivation. Knowledge of fundamentals, flexibility, tolerance for ambiguity, intellectual integrity, ability to toy with ideas, ability to suspend critical judgment, ability to think in images, ability to think in analogies. Well, that's kind of complicated, isn't it? But he said to develop or improve that these traits, self-confidence, construction, constructive nonconformity, and so forth. Now, as a little, another sort of test, this will be an oral one this time. And I'd like for everybody to come up with an answer. This shouldn't be embarrassing to you. Maybe you haven't thought about it before, but kind of think fast on it. If you had the privilege of meeting 1 hour a week for the next year with any person on the earth, and you would take the initiative, you could ask anything you wanted to, and this person would give himself to you for 1 hour a week for the next 12 months, who would you choose and why?
Is the Lord included?
No, not included. Now, this can be a living or dead person. I'm assuming that this is possible, what you're talking about. And that we all do it.
Living or dead, you say?
Yeah. Anybody, speak up, it's ready. Would it make it easier if you stuck to the living?
Hard on mine.
Huh?
I'd pick Paul if you...
Okay, Paul, why would you choose Paul?
I'd like to ask him questions about theology and about ministry and about life.
Okay.
I think I'd pick Timothy because he was Paul's right-hand man and he'd be closer to my age.
I didn't realize you were that old, right?
I meant when he was living.
Now, how many of you would choose Paul? All right, who would you choose?
Which row are we in now?
Are
you living or the dead?
Paul. Take
a look. That's what Paul you're talking about.
Take your choice. You're talking about the Pope, aren't you?
Warren? First.
Well, the first guy that came to my mind was Hudson Taylor.
Okay, why?
To find out the principles under which he claimed and operated in serving God and accomplishing so much for God.
I took Billy Graham, the first from the living.
with keeping the objective clear in spite of all kinds of pressure from every source, not being sidetracked.
I think Dr. Bob Smith of Bethel College, Minneapolis, because his ability to with great intelligence and yet his humility before God and being able to relate to.
Before I ever met Dr. Bob, I had a number of people tell me things about him. Bob Glockner was one of them. He said he is the most Christ-like person I've ever known. He said when I've had some time with him, I feel like I've been in the presence of Jesus Christ. All right, some of our study.
I would choose Lena Sparks because I've spent a lot of time with her, and the more I get to know her, the more I want to be around her.
Okay.
If I wasn't dead, I would choose Dawes. And among the living, I'd choose a businessman in San Francisco, and for the same reason, both of these fellows have been able to stimulate me to think and to act.
I was thinking in terms of women, and two just instantly went into my mind, Henrietta Mears and Amy Carmichael. And I love both those women for their ability to take the minute and make not only a beautiful picture, but a very practical thing out of it, like probing.
All right, well, let's don't label this any further because some of you are unprepared. But if we could get this information from you and catalog it, we would find out two things as far as this particular group is concerned. One is what you feel is the most important quality for a leader, the person you admire. He has what you think is most important. And secondly, this is probably what you feel you need the most. This is the reason that it wouldn't be the same for all of us. All right, we'll get off of that sideline and then get on to the second reason that leaders fail. What was the first reason? Yes. Well, now, wait a minute. I think I do want to pursue that a bit further here. Where's my book that's got my stuff in it here? I stuck a deal in one of these books yesterday, and I got left that book in my office. It looks like it is. Excuse me a minute. That's it. That's what I'm looking for. Pass it around. Thank you. H.J. Teller quoted that the other morning.
Yeah.
I don't know where I got that. I keep it on my desk all the time, but I've had it there for 2 or 3 years. I've forgotten where I got it.
Where are they? Where are you?
Bob, you see it? A man's judgment is no better than his information. I guess we're not ready to go on this next point yet for a little bit, to carry this a bit further. I know we're not. Is sound judgment something that you can develop? Is it hereditary? Is it equal available to everybody? How do you come into the possession of sound judgment? Someone told me, or I read it, I guess, that the greatest gift that God has given to a human being is the ability to weigh evidence. come up with the right answer. That's what distinguishes him from everything else in God's creation. And just incidentally, when you deal with a man about his soul, David said, I said in mine haste, all men are liars. I heard Dr. Walter Wilson say once, the only difference between David and me is that I'll take my time. And he said that a man is never so apt to lie as when you're dealing with him about eternal things. But I think we can just go right ahead and plow in, because he is weighing evidence, and he'll come up with the right answer. He has that ability, and he may tell you. He'll lie back and say, no, that isn't true, I don't believe that. But all the time, he's weighing the evidence. And back in the recesses of his mind, he's filing away the right answer from the Word and what you're telling. So man can do this, weigh evidence. Now, I think there are two or three prerequisites to sound judgment. The first one is a degree of maturity. Under the Constitution, what is the minimum age for a president of the United States?
35.
Now, why is that? Well, I think the founding fathers were wise enough to know that there are some things that the only way you pick them up is to put in time. Does that sound reasonable? How old do you have to be a senator? 29.
I thought it was 32.
So the Constitution limits age. There's certain things a person can only pick up through putting in time. Now, this is an area of maturity. You find very few young men who are mature in the sense we're talking about. It takes experience to develop this. Okay, maturity, stability. Have you ever been around anybody that all the time they go off half-cocked by impulse? Always act under impulse? How do you feel about somebody's judgment that has a reputation for always acting under impulse? Well, they just don't have it. But where that there is maturity, stability, both emotional and physical and mental, and this lack of being impulsive, any person of comparable intelligence is capable of just as good a judgment as another person. It isn't something that you inherit. Everybody is equally capable, I feel. Do you want to discuss that? Now, the stability that we talk about in these four areas, that we must not act under the pressure of what?
Social pressure.
Social pressure? Expediency?
Legalism?
But we must act under the influence of the Word of God, the influence it exerts, or moral principle, what is right. Now, before we get into the second thing here, which involves a group, we have said that personality characteristics cannot be used to determine who is a good leader and who isn't. However, we do have about five things that are universal to all successes. successful leaders. Now, these are not personality characteristics. I don't know what to call them. I suppose we should call them attributes. Is there a difference, you think, between an attribute and a personality characteristic? Well, maybe you can think of a better name, but let's call it attribute. Now, the first one of these, and
you're only going to list two on this prerequisite for sound judgment. That's maturity and stability.
Yeah.
That's it.
The stability is in several realms.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, now we come to the number one attribute of a leader. And I want to quote here, if I can find it. The leader is one who knows with greater than average strength of conviction what he wants to get done and where he wants to go. Every one of them is different from other people in that he has a greater strength of conviction. And the book that I copied this from quoted and said, "The world stands aside to let pass the man who knows whither he is going."
What's the name of the book?
My bibliography is weak. This is 2 or 3 years old. Okay, let me read another statement here.
Can you read that one over again, please?
The world stands aside.
The leader is one who knows.
Who knows with greater than average strength of conviction what he wants to get done and where he wants to go. If you ever spent an hour with Bill Bright, you would know that he's not going to slow down till there's an aggressive evangelistic campaign going on in every one of the 5,000 college campuses in the world. If you spend some time with Jim Rayburn, you know that he's going to burn himself out trying to see that there's a witness to every high school student in the world. Well, I'm going to go a step further in here. This means he possesses clarity and precision as to the objective purposes and aims, which are definite, readily communicable to others, attractive to others, and vigorously, persistently, and enthusiastically sustained by the leader. I don't know whether that's worth copying or not. I don't think it is. This means he possesses clarity and precision as to the objective purposes and aims, which are definite, readily communicatable to others, potentially attractive to others, and vigorously, persistently, and enthusiastically sustained by the leader. There's a Frenchman who had this to say. Balzos, B-A-L-Z-O-S. Conviction brings a silent, indefinable beauty into faces made of the commonest clay. And one other fellow says, it's in the exercise of the will that the men are separated from the boys. And Arnold Bennett said, I think find the necessity or the tense bracing of the will before anything worthwhile can be done. It is the chief thing that distinguishes me from the cat by the fire. Now, all of these things add up. That every leader who has made any significant impact on people and used them, recruited them in his mission, has an extraordinary sense of conviction. Now, I want to digress and preach a little bit here on this before we go on the other four. And we probably won't get any further than this today. Dave Morkin has commented on this. Some of you have heard me preach along this line, but not all of you. Psalm 139. this, to me, is an inner look at what I would call God's soul factory, or the personality factory. And this is where people are made. So he says in verse 15 of Psalm 139, "My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them." Now keep a look at that. We're going to refer back to it. One of the most carefully guarded trade secrets in the United States is the Coca-Cola formula. People all over the world are trying to duplicate it. Do you know how many people know that formula for Coke syrup? There are two people that know it. That's all. Now, it's locked up in a safe, so if something happens to these men, somebody else can find it. But these men, according to an article in Reader's Digest a few years ago, personally supervised the mixing of every gallon of Coke syrup. Well, they probably mix it in bigger batches than that. But these two guys do it. You know that?
And they can't go back and, I mean, if somebody else, if they wanted to, couldn't go back and qualitative analysis and break it down?
I would say that every beverage company in the world has tried to duplicate it. And they've got all kinds of cola. But nobody has discovered it. Yeah. Okay. They make a fetish out of making every gallon like, don't they? Now, by contrast, God, here in Psalm 139, and we compare this with other scripture, we'll find that every time he mixes up a certain formula, ratio of genes and chromosomes, and produces a personality in conformity with that distribution of genes and chromosomes, he throws it away. And he checks it off in his book that we read about here. Listen, it's been fulfilled. Now, he had to design all these things, you see, before he put them into existence. So he wrote all the members in our books with the ratio of genes and chromosomes before we ever made. And he's still going down the line. Meaning that there never has been, and there never will be, two people that are made just alike. Now, let me illustrate this. 1 Corinthians 15. Verse 41. Really, it begins with 40, I guess. But the whole context, I think if you'll study this, you'll see that it substantiates what I'm talking about. Verse 41, "There is one glory of the sun, and another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for one star differeth from another star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead." Now, if we'd go back to verse 35 and on there, we'd find out that God is comparing here that just as every star is different, every person he's created is different. That much variety. Now if we look at Job 38:7, we get a further illustration, I think, in this. As we read it over there in verse 7, Job 38:7, "When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." I have heard scientists say that as you examine the frequency with which the stars release their light, you find that every one of them releases their light on a different frequency. Now, the purpose in this is to provide music. And when the earth was created, Adam, with his hearing unimpaired, had the background of a symphony which encompassed every star in the universe. And they had a great variety because no two of them played the same note. Every one of them. Maybe it was only a millionth of a second, a millionth of a microsecond, difference in frequency. But a perfect harmony. And maybe that's the way God decided how many stars to build up there, how many contributions he could make to the symphony. Now, I heard a story once of a high school band, and one of the guys lost his program. They were giving a concert. So he asked the other guy, and he says, what's our next number? And he says, well, it's America Beautiful. Oh, he says, I just played that. Well, you know what happens when one of the instruments gets out of harmony with the other. Everybody has to be perfect with their note if you're going to have harmony, isn't it? Now, when one person plays another guy's part, there's two tragedies. One is that his own part is missing, and the second is that he drowns out the other, interferes with it. I believe these things teach us that, and we've got other scripture back this up. God has created every individual for a purpose, and the purposes do not duplicate. And a person can only have the Christian conviction that he needs when he knows that he's in the will of God. A Christian has got to know that. And that's the source of his conviction. I know that this is what God has called me to do. And I'm carrying it out with great conviction. So Christian leadership should be different from any other time. There should be greater energy released because of Christian conviction than profit motive or the desire for political power. But I'm not sure this is true. When journalists are looking for a synonym for zeal, what do they always say? Why?
Religious.
Yes, the zeal of an evangelist. Is evangelistic zeal. That's generally what they say, isn't it? Well, this is probably where we see the most Christian conviction is in evangelists. Well, conviction. This is the start. A person has to have this. And I would say that your leadership and my leadership will be effective in direct proportion to the conviction we have that we're in the will of God, doing what he wants us to do. It's dishonoring to God, in my estimation, to even compare ourselves with somebody else. And that's scriptural teaching. If we wanted to go over in Jeremiah and Romans 11, we could read where that God is critical of the clay that turns to potter and says, why hast thou made me thus? Quarrels with his maker because of what he's made. Do you believe that you've got a note to contribute in the eternal harmony? Now, if you don't contribute it, something will be missing. I do. And that's where conviction originates. God mixed the genes and chromosomes the way he wanted them. I don't want to get too far from the sideline on this. But when I'm counseling a person as to how to find the will of God, I try to get some clue as to the genes and chromosomes, what their mixture is in there. Warren and I were talking about this one day, and he pointed out Romans 11:27, that gifts and calling of God are mentioned in the same verse. God does not call a man contrary to his gifts. He gifts a man with certain things, and he calls them to fulfill the gifts. Well, conviction. Now,
11:29.
11:29, what did I say? 27, didn't I? 11:29, yes. The second part of the verse isn't applicable, just the fact these two words are used in the same verse. Now we come to number two. And that is drive. Almost every study of the secret of the successful leader has agreed that the possession of a generous and unusual endowment of physical and nervous energy is essential. And I don't like the word he uses, but this is what he uses, to personal ascendancy. Those who rise in a marked way above the mass of men have conspicuously more drive, more sure endurance, greater vigor of body and mind than the average. Now, there are three ways that you get the energy, aside from the fact that it's derived from conviction. One is inheritance. And I think there's people that are disqualified from inheritance. First time I went to Arizona, I heard about the dog sitting out, and he was whining. So somebody asked the guy at the filling station, he says, why is he whining? And he said, he's lazy. Why does that make him whine? He said, he's sitting on a cactus. Laziness. Second, upbringing and nurture. And three, the conscious use or abuse of our physical organism from day to day.
Use or abuse?
Of our physical organism, yes, from day to day. Use or abuse. That rang true? When you abuse the physical organism, what does it do to your energy?
Dissipate it.
All of it.
Okay. Here's another statement here. A leader's show of energy releases energy. Sound right?
I'd like to hear that one develop.
A leader's show of energy releases energy.
That enthusiasm?
Yeah. Part of it.
Is this under drive or is this a new one?
No, this is still under drive. I have a book here that Men at the Top. This is the managing editor of Newsweek took a year off his job. He sent out 300 questionnaires to the leaders in industry. And then he interviewed personally the leaders of the top 100 corporation chairmen in the United States to try to find out if there was any pattern of what made them what they were. Well, he came up with one thing here that every one of them had in common. He says, what emerges from this, from the quiet and thoughtful steel man, the gum-chewing, khaki-clad banker, the scholarly hummingbird expert from DuPont, the articulate scientist-turned-businessman, the automated Ottoman, and all the rest, is not a simple line drawing. No such portrait can be rendered. But these top men, or most of them, do share a common dynamism. I don't know what that word means. He says, flame maker, James McDonald, translates it as vital balance. We had the vice president of McDonnell Aircraft in charge of research and development out here at our conference week before last. And we, fairly new Christian, I'd met him back in St. Louis. We had some good times, but he had some things to say about his boss, James McDonnell. And he's a man of energy. But he's the one who translated it as the vital balance. Now, another statement here, he says, these men all have a real hunger for work, which they could not satisfy even if they wanted to, which they don't. Now, I don't know whether this is something we can do something about or not. Okay, this is two. Now, the third, and I can't substantiate this in the way that I can some of these others, is a history of achievement. People do not follow a theoretician very far.
Who? Theoretic. Theoretician.
Theoretician. If you could get all the professors of economics out of all our universities and put them in the government, you'd think that you could solve our economic problems. And that's what Kennedy did, didn't he? They don't know anything about economics. They just hand out theories up there. Well, I don't know anything about economics. I'm not qualified to judge. That's a poor illustration. But the people that are looking for somebody to follow, like to follow somebody who has had some success in the area in which he's trying to lead them. I've heard Chuck Farrow bring out that in David's day, when he was just a young man, in Saul's day, that they were in great need of some giant killers out there in the valley. And there was a shortage of giant killers. Saul hadn't raised up any. But 30 years later, when you read the catalog of David's mighty men, was there any shortage? Now, there was a whole list of giant killers. Well, how did David get them? He raised them up.
Yankee contract.
All right, the history of accomplishment, and we could say that this is pace setting.
Eisenhower said, nothing breeds success like success.
And in his book, Crusade in Europe, the key to it is morale, isn't it? And he talked about how you raise the morale, and that was victories, through victories in battle. Now, I'm not sure that this next one I want to read here isn't an overlap of drive and energy. But this was Admiral Sherman who wrote this. Whether or not he becomes a great leader depends upon whether or not he possesses the extra initiative, magnetism, moral courage, and force which make the difference between the average man and the above average man. But the word here is magnetism. Now, this is probably a combination of conviction and drive that creates in him a magnetism that draws people to him. Whether or not he becomes a great leader depends upon whether or not he possesses that extra initiative, magnetism, moral courage, and force which makes a difference between the average man and the above average man. But a key word in there is magnetism. So it's not only the dynamism, but the magnetism.
Don't you think in addition to conviction and drive, you have to include the moral courage? Because it might be the person had conviction and drive, but he might lack the courage to exercise them.
Yes, I think that probably, courage should probably go in there. I don't know just where it fits. I was trying to fit it into the next one here. Now, the next one fits in with our second reason for failure in leadership. And that is an inability to implement the appropriate action once it has been identified to an accurate analysis of the situation. So first of all, the reason the leader fails, he can't size up the situation. And second, he is not able to do what needs to be done with what he has available. Now, this means that a leader has got to be in the possession of resources. I've heard Lauren quote Bob Pierce often, who said that the greatness of Billy Graham is not his message. It's the ability to get the crowds. And he said, how many people do you know that would like to speak from Billy Graham's pulpit? Well, what preacher wouldn't? But who has the courage to bite off $1.5 million TV contract? A lot of people like to preach to all those millions. But this begins where he's willing to stick his neck out and sign a contract for $1.5 million worth of time on TV. Or in, I guess, more and more in the local campaigns, somebody else is responsible for the finances. But originally, this was largely his risk. Well, that's a little off the subject, but what we want to talk about here at this point, an inability to implement the appropriate action once it has been identified and an accurate analysis of the situation. So the first thing that a potential leader has got to do is to come into possession of resources that he can utilize. Now, for our purposes, these resources are a band of men through whom we can accomplish our objectives. So, the application we want to make of this, that the failure of a leader, even though he has the penetrating ability to analyze the situation, know what's wrong, is to utilize men in accomplishing the objective, in solving a problem. Now, we're going to get a little analytical here, and I don't have a blackboard. But I'd like you to take your a blank sheet of paper here as I read some things here that happen. The first problem when you start working with more than one other person, and this is called group relationships. If A supervises two persons, B and C, I put A up the top of the page like this. A, B, and C. Now what we want to see is how many cross relationships exist. If A supervises two persons, B and C, he can deal with them individually or as a pair. Now, if he deals with them individually, how many relationships does he have with them?
Two.
If he deals with them as a pair, What does he have? Well, he has a third relationship. This is different, isn't it? However, the behavior of B in the presence of C and of C in the presence of B will differ from their behavior when each is with A alone. So you throw in two more relationships. Is that right? You find that true? Furthermore, what B thinks of C...
Wouldn't that be just the same as your third one, dealing with them both together?
Well, no, I don't think it would. You deal with them together, but you've got a new relationship than if you were dealing with each one of them individually.
Right, but that'd still be three. It could be dealing with each one individually, or dealing with...
Well, mathematically, we don't want to bog down in this. These are additional relationships.
But when, in other words, individually, collectively, they're different.
Yes.
But wouldn't it be different if you were dealing with one person in the presence of another?
That's right. You've got a new problem to solve. Okay. If you're dealing with B in the presence of C or C in the presence of B.
Okay.
Furthermore, what B thinks of C and what C thinks of B constitute two cross relationships which A must keep in mind when delegating work on which B and C must collaborate in A's absence. So they act one way in his presence. They act another way when they are working without you present. That's another thing you've got to take into consideration. So this is six relationships. In other words, even in this extremely simple unit of organization with two subordinates, a superior must keep six relationships constantly in mind. Now, do you follow me in this? This too detailed? You know how wearing it gets when you've got to supervise two people, because you've got to keep in mind... When you're with them individually, that's fine. But you get them together, then you got, well, this, that, and the other. Then when a third subordinate D is added, A's direct relationships with individuals increase by only one. But the various groupings he may have to deal with will increase by seven. Now when you add the fourth one, it goes to 18. Cross relationships that you've got. Now that was 3 is 18. 4 is 44. 6 jumps you to 450.
That's reason 6 might be a span of control.
Right.
Idea.
Well, you see why it's so worrying when you're trying to keep a group straightened, keep them happy? You can identify at least 450 different cross relationships that you've got to keep strong.
And 6 is what?
We didn't go to 6. Yeah, 6 is 450 to 500. Now, wait a minute. I'm ahead of myself. Excuse me here. 6 is 200. 7 is 450 to 500. Now, in this connection, we'll talk about, in operating with a group, what is called the span of control that Jerry just mentioned, but which is the basis of all sound organization. And here is the theory in this. The average human brain finds its effective scope in handling from 3 to 6 other brains. If a man divides the whole of his work into two branches and delegates his responsibility freely and properly to two experienced heads of branches, he will not have enough to do. The occasions when they would refer to him would be too few to keep him fully occupied. If he delegates to 3 heads, he will be kept fairly busy, while 6 heads of branches will give most bosses a 10-hour day. These data are the results of centuries of experience of soldiers. Organizations are run by rule, then, a rule whereby from 3 to 6 hands are shepherded by one head, each head in turn being member of a superior group from 3 to 6 who are being wheeled into line one by one. Now, this is not a matter of IQ. The telephone company is in for some great headaches in the next few years. And the dividends on AT&T stock are not going to be as big as they've been, although it's been a pretty good stock to own down through the years. Because they're going to have to put on a lot of extra operators in their information section. The reason is the human brain is only capable of retaining 6 separate and unrelated functions. So years ago, to solve this, the telephone company duplicated on the dial. And you have letters and you have numbers. Actually, they're saying you could either use the letters or the numbers, couldn't you? But realizing that the human brain could not retain more than 6, they have a prefix. Now, this is completely disassociated from numbers. So you can remember the prefix, and you can remember the 6 numbers. But when you go beyond 6, you can't do it. Now, how many of you can memorize telephone numbers now the way you used to? Wrong. Sorry. Well, from a telephone's viewpoint, the more numbers you have memorized, the less information calls you have. But the number of telephone numbers you carry around your mind is going to greatly decrease. Now, all of them that have the same prefix, perhaps you can remember these. But the human brain is not engineered to remember more than 6 disassociated functions. Now, maybe that's a poor illustration. So, as the illustration goes out to point here, one NCO, one corporal, in charge of 3 privates is too idle. While one lieutenant general in charge of 6 divisional generals would be too busy. A corporal in charge of 6 would be more frustrated than a general in charge of 5. Wouldn't he? You see the point here? This isn't a matter of IQ. Now, there are exceptions to this. One would be a sales manager, where everybody is doing the same thing. And so you can supervise more people. But God has not equipped any human being to retain more than 6 separate and unrelated functions in his mind. So if your work, your ministry, is divided up to where that you're trying to supervise more functions than this, you're going to be inefficient. Your leadership will be ineffective. 2 things will result. One is, there's so many people looking to you that they can't get to you. Therefore, they will do one of two things. They will either do nothing until they get to you, or they will make an unsound decision because they didn't have the information that you had in your mind on which to make it. So any time that you find inefficiency, low morale in any kind of an organization, generally you can trace it to the violation of this concept, that the man who's in charge is inaccessible to his people. They do nothing or they do it inefficiently. Now, on the other hand, if he has too few, he will over-supervise and constantly destroy their initiative, and they will not develop or be any good. Now, let me read a little takeoff on this.
This pretty much sets the limit of now families, doesn't it?
Yeah, unless you have twins. Okay, let me read you something from Parkinson's law. And his law is, work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. That's his basic law. Now we've got an illustration of what happens here. the whole thing is interesting, but there's just one thing I want to read here. Where to start?
Quite a noted lecture.
To comprehend this factor, we must picture a civil servant called A who finds himself overworked. Now you call this Navigator A. Whether this overwork is real or imaginary is immaterial, but we must observe in passing that A's illusion might easily result from his own decreasing energy, a normal symptom of middle age. For this real or imagined overwork, there are, broadly speaking, three possible remedies. He may resign. He may ask to have the work with a colleague called B. He may demand the assistance of two subordinates called C and D. There is probably no instance in history, however, of A choosing any but the third alternative.
That's the two assistants?
Yeah. What was the first alternative?
Resign.
Second?
One man.
Has it.
Devise his job with somebody else. But in every instant of history, what does he do?
Picks up two buddies.
Yeah. However,
that may be a little bit of an oversimplification.
No. By resignation, he would lose his pension rights. By having B appointed on his own level in the hierarchy, he would merely bring in a rival for promotion. So A would rather have C and D, junior men, below him. They will add to his consequence, and by dividing work into two categories as between C and D, he will have the merit of being the only man who comprehends them both. It is essential to realize at this point that C and D are, as it were, inseparable. To appoint C alone would have been impossible. Why? Because C, if by himself, would divide the work with A and so assume the equal status that he has refused in the first instance to be. A status the more emphasized if C is A's only possible successor. Subordinates must thus number two or more, each being kept in order by fear of the other's promotion. When C complains in turn of being overworked, as he certainly will, A will, with the concurrence of C, advise the appointment of two assistants to help C. But he can then avert internal friction only by advising the appointment of two more assistants to help D, whose position is much the same. With this recruitment of E and F and G and H, the promotion of A is now practically certain. Seven officials are now doing what one did before. This is where factor two comes into operation. For these seven make so much work for each other that all are fully occupied and A is actually working harder than ever.
What page are you reading from?
Page five. Now, here's an illustration of what happens. An incoming document may well come before each of them in turn. Official E decides that it falls within the province of F, who places a draft reply before C, who amends it drastically before consulting D, who asks G to deal with it. But G goes on leave at this point, handing the file over to H, who drafts a minute that is signed by D and returned to C, who revises his draft accordingly and lays the new version before A. What does A do? He would have every excuse for signing the thing unread, for he has many other matters on his mind. Knowing now that he is to succeed W next year, he has to decide whether C or D should succeed to his own office. He had to agree to C's going on leave, even if not yet strictly entitled to it. He is worried whether H should not have gone instead for reasons of health. He has looked pale recently. Partly, but not solely, because of his domestic troubles. Then there is the business of F's special increment of salary for the period of the conference and E's application for transfer to the Ministry of Pensions.
A has heard that D is in love with a married typist and that G and F are no longer on speaking terms. No one seems to know why. So A might be tempted to sign C's draft and have done with it, but A is a conscientious man. Beset as he is with problems created by his colleagues for themselves and for him, created by the mere fact that these officials' existence, he is not a man to shirk his duty. He reads through the draft with care, deletes the fussy paragraphs added by C and H, and restores the thing back to the form preferred in the first instance by the able if quarrelsome F. He corrects the English. None of these young men can write grammatically. And finally produces the same reply he would have written if official C and H had never been born. Far more people have taken far longer to produce this same result. No one has been idle. All have done their best. And it is late in the evening before A finally quits his office and begins to journey to Ealing. The last of the office lights are being turned off in the gathering dusk that marks the end of another day's administrative toil. Among the last to leave, A reflects with bowed shoulders and a wry smile that late hours, like gray hairs, are among the penalties of success. From this description of the factors at work, the student of political science will recognize that administrators are more or less bound to multiply, and so forth. Now, he points out in his table, and this is written by a Britisher, that in the British Navy, in 1914, they had 62 ships, 146,000 officers. In 1928, they had
146,000.
Yeah, 150,000. I'll give you the whole table if you want it. 146,000 officers and 2,000 admiralty officials. 57,000 dockyard workers and 3,200 miscellaneous officials. 14 years later. They had 20 ships in commission. They had decreased the ships by 67%. They had only reduced the officers and men in the Navy by 31%. The dockyard workers had increased by 9%, the officials and clerks by 40%, and the admiralty officials by 78%. They decreased their ships from 62 to 20 and increased the people supervising by 78%. Well, that's the way administration multiplies. Now, my whole purpose in getting into this is to point out how that problems multiply with people. And the reason that leaders fail, they do not know how to recruit and to mold these people in the people that help them carry out their objective instead of remove them from it. World War II, an aircraft carrier, was quite a weapon. But there was never a time in my knowledge that any aircraft carrier in the Navy didn't have enough job orders and improvements on it to keep it in the Navy Yard for 10 years. Just to catch up with the backlog of improvements. The thing was supposed to get out and fight the war, but there was so much going on internally. So they just had to send them out the way they were. Well, now, is there any practical application of what we're talking about here? When you get two people working for you, have you got a challenge to keep them on the objective? You worry about their health and their leave and their training and so forth. And what can they very easily do? Whereas you got them to be a resource to carry out your objective, they can nullify the objective if you don't know how to handle them. Now, I'm going to give you a suggestion as to the heart
in my estimation, of molding the people into a band which will get on with the mission. And all I'm going to do is just make a statement. I'm not going to give you any solution particularly in this. What you have got to have in your band is what's sometimes called a morale and a fighting spirit that will maintain the objective. That's what you've got to have. High morale is produced in only one way, and that is that every need of every band member has got to be met. When you have a group of men with no unsatisfied needs, you've got this fighting unit. Okay, Leroy is still requesting that we get this on tape here in a way that can be heard. Okay, now let me give an illustration of what I'm talking about here. I worked for a few months for a captain in the Navy that the people in the Navy Department were so anxious to make an admiral out of him that the minute he was eligible, they passed over two entire Naval Academy classes to pick him up. And that set well with these two classes, of course. They didn't produce any admiral material. They picked him up, a young man. One of the reasons was that every campaign, every battle, every time he'd gone into action in World War II, he had accomplished his mission and been decorated. His jacket wouldn't hold the ribbons. Because every time, that's what he did. He cleaned it out. Smashing success. He was a commander of an aircraft combat squadron. So I asked him one day, I said, Captain, I know that it must not have been any accident that you were successful. I said, what was the secret that you had? He said, well, it's very simple. He said, first of all, my men knew that they had the finest equipment that had been invented or that could be bought. And I said, secondly, I had them so trained that there was nothing they didn't know about the equipment. They knew how it worked and how to use it and how to cope with any malfunction that came up that thorough. And he said, thirdly, I saw that every one of them had a will made out. He had adequate life insurance. He had the power of attorney given to someone, so that when he went into battle, he didn't say, now, I wish that I'd made this provision for my family in case I didn't come back. He made sure that everything they wanted to do or would ever want to do had been done. So, when they went into battle, there was no distraction. They weren't worried about whether they had good equipment. They weren't worried about how to operate it. They weren't worried about their families. So they just got out there and fought. And they won every time. Well, this is an example of meeting every need that they had, that he could identify. Now, of course, if he'd have been a Christian, he'd have gone a step further in this, wouldn't he? But he had a pretty good crew on there. And he had a way of creating high morale. When I was an ensign, he wrote a special letter to the Navy Department recommending me for a spot promotion to lieutenant commander. And he gave 2 pages of why this should be done. Well, they didn't do it. But then he got his point over with me. I worked pretty hard for him after that. Now, let me just mention something that I can't back up here, and this will about bring us to a conclusion.
I feel that in a band of men, there are five relationships which must exist. And I could illustrate each one of these from Scripture, but we won't take the time to do it. First, on the part of the leader, two relationships. It must be known that he is willing to lay down his life for his conviction, his belief in Christ. Did you get a challenge out of this Buddhist over in Saigon? And now there's a woman going to do the same thing. You all know what I'm talking about. Well, actually, Vietnam is 90% Buddhist, but due to the French influence, the government is Catholic. And if you go out there to the capital of Saigon, you'll see this big statue of Mary. And one of the last things the French did before they pulled out was to declare it a Catholic country, with the result that there's some persecution of the Buddhists from the head of government who are under Catholic influence. So this Buddhist priest, in protest, wrapped himself in burlap, soaked it with gasoline, and set himself afire, announced he was going to do it. He did it out in the public square with a bunch of people watching as a protest against how his religion was being. Oppressed. Okay. The leader must be willing to lay down his life for his conviction. Two, must be willing to lay down his life for his men. As far as I know, Jesus Christ is the only person who has actually done this. Now, other leaders in varying degrees have laid down something for their men. I heard about Napoleon. Once he was making an inspection late at night, and he came on a sentry that was asleep. So he picked up his rifle and began to walk his post. And a couple hours later, the guy woke up. And when he saw who was walking his post, he was really shook. But Napoleon told him, he said, "Now, I know you're tired. We've had a hard day. But," he said, "the lives of a lot of these soldiers depend on you. And I hope you're rested enough that you can fulfill your duty." And he went on. Well, he didn't expect that kind of treatment, I don't think. But you can see why people will follow that kind of person. Well, he didn't lay down his life, but he gave up some of his sleep for him, didn't he? Okay, now the three relationships with the men in the band, the members of the band. Number one, they must also be willing to lay down their lives for their conviction. Secondly, they must be willing to lay down their lives for their leader. You remember one day when David said he sure wished he had a drink of that water of Abdullah? Mm-hmm. And pretty soon here they came back with it. And David poured it on the ground. I know I used to think that they sneaked around and got some water. But when they came back, they were a bloody mess. And the scripture says that they slew a host to get through. I don't know how many a host is, do you? But when David saw them and saw the blood all over them, he said, "This is the price of blood." And he had an illustration right in front of him, because they fought through and killed a host of enemies to get this one. Okay, willing to lay down their lives for the leader. Now, the third relationship here must be willing to lay down their lives for one another. This is illustrated in the case of Uriah. You remember that David called him in, and we won't go into the details of it. His loyalty had transferred from David to Joab. And he talked pretty straight to David. And he says, "As thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing." And when he did, he signed his death warrant. And so David fixed him up with this note. And they went out, and he told him, he said, "Now you put Uriah in the thickest part of battle." Now, I don't know how they were organized, but I kind of have a feeling that David's mighty men were organized into kind of flying wedges. That's the reason they survived the whole war. And they had some kind of a setup where every guy protected a certain part or another. And so they could put an advanced man up there, and then they'd cover him. And nobody could touch him while he was mowing them down. And then when he got tired, they'd shift another man up to the top of the wedge. So when Joab got the thing, he said, put Uriah up the point of the wedge, and then desert him. Well, he had fought with these guys for 20 years, and he knew they'd protect him. But they put him up at the point, and when they got him up, they fell back. Now, I don't think Uriah was a naive person. He knew something was cooking. After he talked this way with David, he might even read the note. But the reason, in my mind, that he wouldn't compromise and act like a civilian was that he would have been the laughingstock of that gang that he was a part of if he had gone home and acted like a civilian. He said he wouldn't do it because he was more interested in the group, being a part of it, and being fully accepted than anything else. And he laid down his life before he would let them down. Now, these are highly theoretical relationships, but they're a pattern of what must happen. So I don't know whether there's anything practical in this or not. We're ready to come to a conclusion here. But we're sure just hitting one or two points. Why the leader fails, that he can't size up the situation. And having sized up the situation, he doesn't have the resources to move in and doesn't know how to direct it in the accomplishment of what needs to be done. There's a lot of people that can sit back and analyze the situation accurately that can't lead resources in to accomplish it. Is that right? Now let's review and summarize here, and then tomorrow we're going into a bunch of unrelated things, just techniques of leadership. What are you letting yourself in for when you start organizing a band of men? Trouble, aren't you? Now, mathematically, can you identify what caused them?
Cross relationships.
The number of cross relationships that you've got to take into consideration. And what do you think about Parkinson's statement here about the guy that had two assistants? He ended up with seven people. Did they help him? He was working harder than ever.
He writes to be read. Dispel light, probably.
Well, yes, this, I would say, is not valid all the way through, but there's a valid principle in this. And the people that you recruit to help you can make you work harder and actually draw you away from your objective if they're not with you, if you don't know how to mold them into a unit. Is that right?
Right.
Now, according to my theory, how do you mold them? What have you got to do?
Meet every one of their needs.
See that every need they have is met. Now, spiritually, how about the equipment that a guy has? That's the place to start, isn't it? Make sure he's equipped. And then lead him on. Now, these other things I say are highly theoretical, these five relationships. But you can identify quite a few of them in action in Gideon's 300. If we had a whole week on this, we would analyze and discover these principles in Gideon's leadership.
of his 300. And that was probably, from the human standpoint, the greatest calculated risk that's ever been taken in the history of warfare. As he took 300 men against an army that somebody says 135,000 over there. But even if they were only the same number of the Israelites' original army, they'd be outnumbered 100-1 in here. But the principle of the leadership is in there in this account.
Well, anybody have anything else to say? Some of you haven't said a word. Joyce, you haven't said a word.
Well, this is all pretty technical, but I'm gaining a lot from it. And I think especially as I've seen more personalities involved in London, I can really see the wisdom of this in the relationships.
Remember what Lauren said the other day on the platform Sunday afternoon? He said, no matter how big the organization grows, I can still only have 5 assistants, whether there's 100 or 10,000. He will still operate through 5 assistants. Is that right? Okay. Any further comment before we conclude?
I sometime would be interested in your thoughts on Moses' organization when he split up his 600,000 men into captains of thousands and fifties and hundreds and tens.
I've got a chart prepared by a military, a general, an admiral, that appeared, in fact, I haven't got it. I've got a Thermofax copy. Lauren took it away from me. It appeared in the Navy Chaplain's Bulletin, and it showed the organization chart drawn up, all the blocks, and in every one of them was Moses. You know, he had 20 departments, and he was the head of every one of them when he started out. Then it showed his revised organization over there. 20 departments, Moses, 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 Moses.
Jim, one of the things, of course, implementing this is going to be the many myriads of details, little things, of how to build morale. For instance, when this captain recommend you for lieutenant commander. Make application of those things. How?
Okay, well, we'll take some time to discuss that more. But tomorrow, I'm going to start off by reading How to Organize Your Time and give you a $25,000 secret. Charles Schwab, the president of Bethlehem Steel, paid $25,000 for that secret from an efficiency expert. But three for nothing tomorrow. Okay? Let's conclude with a word of prayer. Noel Nelson, will you lead us, please?